many years ago, in the 1980s, Daniel Yankelevich in Atlantic Monthly wrote an article on the changing rules of American life. And 3 decades have gone by, and we've seen the implications of what the secular thinker had analyzed in his article. And here's what he said as a beginning definition, quoting the sociologist Daniel Bell. Listen carefully, please. He says, culture is an effort to provide a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all human beings in the passage of their lives. Do you hear that? To provide a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all human beings in the passage of their lives. And a genuine cultural revolution then is one that makes a decisive break from the shared meanings of the past, particularly those which relate to the deepest questions of the purpose and nature of human life. So if the goal is to find a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all of us in the pursuit of our lives, and that a cultural revolution is underway when we make a decisive break from the shared meanings of the past, particularly those that relate to the purpose and nature of human life. Now, if you take that definition alone, there's enough there to try to unpack. I'm not going to try to unpack this, but this alone tells me that when you're looking for definitions or deviations, you have to go back to the original assumption of what is the purpose and the nature of human life. So questions of moral reasoning can only truly be postulated if we have assumed on a common purpose. If we vary in our purpose, how are we ever going to arrive at our conclusions? You know, I could give you 3 simple analyses of how cultures function. There's going to be a speed course in it for just a 2 and a half minute type thing. Cultures are defined in sort of 3 different ways. One is called a theonomous culture. Theonomous, theos God, nomos law, where it is assumed in the mainstream and the flow of the culture that the theos, the God, whom we all sort of in some sense subscribe to, has put his law into our hearts so that we act intuitively from that kind of reasoning. One of the best cultures to exemplify this is the Indian culture, the culture in which I was raised. The respect for parents, the love for family, and all of these, and the heritage play a vital part. In a sense, it's a theonomous type of culture where the divine imperatives are sort of planted within the heart or the conscience of every human being. We move then to a heteronomous culture. Heteros meaning different, nomos law, a different law, where there is a superimposition upon a culture from an exterior source. In religious terms, Islam is a heteronomic culture. You are told and dictated to from the outside, your dietary laws, your celebratory festivals, how you are to practice it. All of your practices are dictated to you from another source, an authoritative source. Islam has that heteronomic value implicit in its own teaching. There's no dispute on that. They would accept that as a fair description. And in secular ideas, Marxism would be that kind of a heteronomous culture where the few dictate the values of the many. So you've got theonomous, God's law sort of in our own hearts, and we move along as a culture with a coherent set of values. Heteronomous, where we are told from the outside what our dictates should be. But then there is an autonomous culture, autos meaning self, nomos law, where each one is a law unto himself or herself. And America would probably describe herself as an autonomous culture where every individual dictates his or her own moral reasoning. The fascinating thing that has happened in our time, even though we are told we are an autonomous culture, if my values autonomously then move to the fact that life is sacred, all of a sudden a heteronomous culture takes over in dictating to me that I have no right to believe it and share that in a community in any sense of dissenting value systems. Hope you followed what I've said, that if I have autonomy, Why is it all of a sudden, if I believe that life is sacred and the values that I hold to are sacred, that all of a sudden I'm told from outside sources, yes, we are in theory autonomous, but you had daren't ever tell the public audience what you believe is right and wrong. Only my belief can be shared as it disagrees with yours. You have no right to ultimately publicly proclaim what you believe. So are we really autonomous then? Or do we bait and switch, allow the person to believe they're autonomous, but if they violate this, we become suddenly heteronomous? That is the new worldview under which the term tolerance really operates. That's the new worldview under which the word tolerance really operates. Now, how did all of this come about? I share with you three dramatic changes that took place. The first is called secularization. Secularization is the process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. It is a process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. One satirist puts it this way: first, dentistry was painless, then bicycles were chainless, and carriages were horseless, and many laws enforceless. Next, cookery was fireless, telegraphy was wireless, cigars were nicotineless, and coffee caffeineless. Soon oranges were seedless, the putting green was weedless, the college boy was hatless, the proper diet fatless. New motor roads are dustless, the latest steel is rustless, our tennis courts are sodless, our new religion godless. That is secularization in action, where religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. When this happens, a cultural inversion takes place. And let me move to illustrate this for you so that I can move quickly to my second and third sociological phenomena that I think brought all of this about. I remember in the 1980s when I moved to Atlanta from Toronto, we were living in Toronto prior to that, watching the transcripts of a trial that had taken place with the pornographic entrepreneur Larry Flint. And the general opinion was that Larry Flint's pornography was so off the charts that he even made Playboy magazine look quite normal and acceptable, that the deviance to which he had gone was absolutely unthinkable, and lawyers, court cases were brought against him. But the lawyer defending Larry Flint was very clever. The first thing he did was he said he only wanted people on the jury who did not belong to any church. And so that took a while for them to find somebody in the South who didn't belong to any church. So it took many, many days till the jury was complete. And then when the witnesses came to testify against Mr. Flint, the lawyer defending Flint went about it this way. He would say to them this: have you ever been into an art gallery? Yes. Have you ever paid to go into an art gallery? Yes. Have you ever paid to go into an art gallery where you've seen paintings by the great masters of art of unclothed people? Yes. Will you please tell this jury why you call that art and paid to go in to see it, and you call my client stuff pornography? On a witness box, how do you even deal with this? You're not going to get into some philosophical argument on the way you arrive at ethical values and so on, not with a lawyer with all of his neurotic stare gazing down at you like that. And I thought to myself, you know, what would I say? What would I say to him? But I think the ultimate argument has to filter down into something more engaging on the issue of reason here. So please track me with me. When C.S. Lewis, in his book, gave his allegorical fashion his story of his conversion, Pilgrim's Regress. The reason he calls it a Pilgrim's Regress rather than progress is because if you know Lewis's conversion story, how he moved from one worldview to another, from atheism to pantheism, he struggled with pantheism for some time, till ultimately, in his words, he was dragged into the kingdom, kicking and screaming, the most reluctant convert in all of England. And then he went on to say, I thought I'd come to a place, I found out I'd come to a person. That's the first line of that close next chapter. I thought I'd come to a place, I found out I'd come to a person. And this theistic framework and this relationship then redefined everything. But in this allegorical journey, while he's going through the philosophy of humanism, the incredible thing is that he pictures himself as a man sitting in a mountain called the spirit of the age, bound in chains. That's an amazing description of the humanistic worldview for a man in the thick of it. You would think of him as robust and free without any law, but he pictures himself as bound and in chains. And the waiter comes and offers him a glass of milk, and he unbinds his chains and he takes the milk and he's drinking it, and he makes the comment, "This is delicious, nutritious milk." And the waiter looks at him and says, "You just call it delicious, nutritious milk. It's nothing more than the secretion of a cow." So the cow secretes urine, it secretes milk. What's the difference? And then young John makes the mistake of saying, "I should never have said it, but I commented on the tastiness of the eggs." And at this point, the analogy he drew, I won't draw for you. Quite pathetic, quite nauseating, really. And he said he just groaned under that description, finished his breakfast, hurriedly pushed the tray away. And then he says this, "All of a sudden, reason came riding on a horse and rescued me and said to the waiter, 'You lie, you lie. You don't know the difference between what nature's meant for nourishment and what nature's meant for garbage.'" You see, at least in the grand artist scheme of things, maybe in the portrayal of the human body, however it was done with whatever intent, all right, you give that artist the benefit of the doubt. But when a young woman or man unclad is in front of the lens of a camera for the pure purpose of titillating the baser instincts in the mind of another person to a point where it will almost ineradicably ruin their minds and imagination and ultimately take them to a point of even the ruination of their marriage. Is that mere art? How many people do you find who go into an art gallery, come back and say, "You know, I saw a painting on the wall and it ruined my marriage ultimately"? But the woman in front of that lens or the young man in front of the lens ought to look at the photographer and say, "Don't do this to me. Please don't do this to me," in this dehumanization process of just so destroying the imagination of someone in an insatiable way that they'll never be satisfied. But when secularization has had its full course, a young man or a young woman like that will never do it. Do you know why? Because the process of secularization, when it's done its work, will ultimately destroy a sense of shame within a culture. You take shame away. You take shame away from a highly educated person, and you've got a monster in the making. That's precisely what Hitler wrote. Exact words when he has him pinned today on Auschwitz. "I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. No shame, no guilt." Even today, psychiatrists are wrestling with the possibility of a drug that can actually deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. But their great struggle of their own consciences, if we can find a drug which can take away and deal with the memory of these horrific things that were done under their watch, what if a rapist takes it the morning after and wipes out his own memory of all the awful things that he did? Can we afford to invent a drug that a murderer or a rapist can actually ingest the next morning and have no sense of shame and no sense of remorse, no sense of regret? The danger with the kind of world that the Sam Harrises ultimately say, not with intent, but with logical outworking, is that it'll produce a generation of men and women without shame. And I'll tell you, the tragedy of that is a production of hell. Just 3 days ago, I had one of those landmark experiences in my life. I was talking to some of my colleagues at dinner on this last night. You know, I've done this now, been a speaker on the circuit for nearly 4 decades. And if I were to take 8 or 10 moments in life that defined me, I would say this Tuesday of this week defined some of that for me. I was at Angola prison, speaking to 5,300 prisoners, 80% of whom are on life without parole. Think of that. On death row, there were 45 with whom my friends and I walked past and chatted, put our hands through the bars, shook hands with them. A tiny little cot, a tiny night table, the toilet there, no doors, nothing, just the bars, and they share televisions. I talked to one young guy there. I wouldn't name him for you, relatively young. I said, how long have you been? I'm not allowed to ask how long they've been there. I just said, how are you doing? He said, fine. He said, I've been here 16 years on death row, you know. I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 35. I said, you were here from when you were 19? He said, yes, sir. And I was not allowed to ask why they're there. He looked at me and he said, I got involved with organized crime when I was 16. And he said, like a dog going back to the vomit, I kept going back and kept going back. And the things I did, I wouldn't even describe for you. And here I am now awaiting the final day till they'll take me out for my last meal and do away with me. You know what? When you go to the execution chamber, it's a very sobering thing to look at. In fact, when I came back, I'm still processing it, still processing it. I told my wife, I said, I want to take every member of my team there. They have this stretcher laid out with straps and the injection that is finally given. It used to be electrocuted, now the injection is given. And the prisoners there build coffins. But they asked the prisoners if they would build this bed on which the injection was administered. They refused because they said our own mates will be killed on that. Interesting, isn't it? Men who are probably there for killing somebody else didn't want to create an instrument that would kill their own mates and their own buddies. It tells you that deep inside your conscience, there is that struggle that goes on the sacredness of life and the inviolability of it. When they lost their sense of shame, they destroyed other lives. When the sober-minded thinking came back, they said, we can't do anything like this. Secularization has a deadly effect when it is uninformed by a transcendent moral order. Pluralization is the next wave with which we moved, where there is a competing number of worldviews available to its members and no one worldview is dominant. A competing number of worldviews available to its members, and no one worldview is dominant. Pluralization is a good thing, to have a competing now, to have different accents, to have different languages. There's a fast food outlet in Los Angeles. It's where a Korean is selling kosher tacos. That's quite a culinarily pluralistic offering out of his little wagon out there. Quite fascinating to watch. When I first came to Canada, when I was 20 years old, there were 500 Indians in Toronto. 500. Today they're all there in taxis waiting for you at the airport to pick you up. There's 500,000 of them in Toronto now. Toronto is where I'd moved to and lived for 10 years, where I met my wife and married. When I came to Toronto at that time, if I saw another Indian, you'd cross the street to say hello and say, Chai Pee Nai, I want to go and have a cup of tea. Now, if you did that, you'd do nothing else. The demographic has changed in these cultures. Pluralism is a good thing. But if pluralism is extended to mean relativism, then it's a deadly thing. If a relativistic ethic is espoused, then you end up with the lowest common denominator. G.K. Chesterton, describing the tragedy of this Botan-type thinking, says this: the new rebel is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty, therefore he can never be a true revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. So he writes one book complaining that imperial oppression insults the purity of women, and then he writes another book, a novel, in which he insults it himself. He curses the Sultan because Christian girls lose their virginity, then curses Mrs. Grundy because they keep it. As a politician, he cries out that war is a waste of life, then as a philosopher that life itself is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself. A man denounces marriage as a lie, then denounces aristocratic profligates for treating it as a lie. He calls the flag a bauble, then blames the oppressors of Poland or Ireland because they take away that bauble. The man of this school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages savages are treated as if they were beasts. Then he takes his hat and umbrella and goes on to a scientific meeting where he proves that they practically are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt. By rebelling against everything, he's lost his right to rebel against anything. And the rock musician says, cat's foot, iron claw. Neurosurgeon scream for more from paranoia's poison door. 21st century schizoid man. Dead seed, blind man's greed. Poet starving, children bleed. Nothing he's got he really needs. 21st century schizoid man. Blood rack, barbed wire, politicians, funeral pyre, innocents raped with napalm fire, 21st century schizoid man. The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time are sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh, but I'm afraid tomorrow I'll be crying. The death of reason. The end of reason. When relativism is absolutized to a point where you become the self-referencing point of all moral reasoning. Ladies and gentlemen, secularization leads you to no sense of shame. In the 60s, we began to see this encroaching into our culture. Pluralization, on the heels of all of that in the academy, the law of non-contradiction was assaulted. And the so-called both hand, which is really not ultimately lived out anyway, takes wings and soars into our cultural ethos. And when I look upon it and say, the end of it is the end of shame and secularization, the end of reason and pluralization, which leads you to the last, and that is privatization. Privatization is a cleavage, a breakdown in your experience between your public and your private life, and you're forced to find meaning in your private life. There's a cleavage, there's a breakdown. And what happens when that takes place? What happens is a complete loss and a complete death of meaning. No shame, no reason, no meaning. That's where we are today. That's where we are today. That's why you have come here today. Because you know the answers of the world are just not making sense, and you're hungry to find what is the best way to communicate this. You know, I was only 17 years old when I ended up on a bed of suicide. I know what it is to hunger for meaning and not have it. I know what it is to be ashamed of the way my life was going and not wanting to ever face people. I knew the irrationality of my own choices, and the thing that I least expected, a man walked into my hospital room with a Bible. And the words of Jesus to Thomas, because I live, you also shall live, so struck to my heart like a pierced instrument would. As we walked away from Angola, the chaplain to the University of Virginia basketball and football teams, a guy about 6'6", 250, big guy, George Morris, walked away, and he's walking beside me back to the plane, and he says, you know, Ravi, in every cell I saw a Bible. But if we put that same Bible in our high schools today, they'll take us to court for invading into the life of young men and women. He said, I guarantee you that if more of those Bibles are in those high schools, there'll be less of these people behind these bars today.